Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
If you've read Hanya Yanagihara's novel, A Little Life, you will not soon forget Jude St. Francis. A survivor of horrendous abuse in childhood, as an adult, he is handsome, professionally successful, and deeply loved by his friends. But the real damage of his trauma is that love cannot penetrate its physical and emotional scars. Jude will never be okay, and he knows it long before readers are willing to accept that conclusion. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. A Little Life was a finalist for a National Book Award and the Man Booker Prize and won the Kirkus Prize. It was on 2015 Best Book List in the New York Times, The Economist, Vanity Fair, and on NPR. Remarkably, its author has kept her day job, currently as editor at T, the New York Times style magazine. She's in town for an Arts and Letters Live event tonight at the Dallas Museum of Art, where she and I will sit down for an extended conversation. Hanya, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much for having me, Chris.
At its heart, this is really about deep and loyal friendships between men. How did you get a sense for what happens between men when women are not around?
Well, I don't know if I got it right, but, you know, I went to an all-female college, and then I graduated into an all-female industry. I went into book publishing when I moved to New York. And so really the years that I should have been watching boys become men, I wasn't. And so because of that, they were perhaps of a greater interest to me than they should have been from an anthropological perspective. And, you know, now that I'm an adult, they're less interesting by the year. But at the time, I was struck by how men communicated with one another. And there really is a sameness to it. There's a sense of what they say to mean something that they're not allowed to say, you know, and there's a sense of what they're not allowed to express, namely vulnerability or shame or fear. And there's also a sense that you can tell, even among the most physical of male friendships, that there are certain lines in which they daren't cross. And for women, of course, that physical language and the language in general is much less constrained and much more permissive. And so I found it fascinating to watch my male friends, whether they were gay or straight and of varying ages, sort of fall into these patterns of behavior when they knew someone was witnessing them.
Do you have the sense that men would like to express themselves in different ways but simply don't know how? Or is it something that they don't even think to wish for?
I think it's something that's steamed out of them at a young age. You know, I remember when my brother was little, he was a very sweet little boy and very physically demonstrative and really, you know, loved to hug his friends and kiss them. And at some point he stopped. And it wasn't anything that my parents taught him to do. So it must have been something that school taught him to do or that his peers taught him to do. But there is a certain age, you know, kind of around 7 or 8, when boys just stop being who they are and become someone else. And when we talk about boys becoming boys, I think it's often what we're referring to, that cessation of physical contact and sort of a certain kind of affection. So it's not that males don't have it within them to be as emotionally complex and vulnerable and giving and so on as women do, if we're speaking in broad and reductive strokes, but it's that they're certainly not encouraged to, especially as they get older.
There is debate on the internet, you may or may not be aware of it, that about whether you have written the great gay novel. First of all, what does that term mean to you?
Well, you know, I don't read any of my reviews, so, and I haven't read this essay either, although I know the writer a little bit, and he's a brilliant critic. So when I found out that he was going to do it, because we have the same agent, so I knew it was coming, I actually thought it was a remarkable and fascinating and flattering way of reading the book, and one I hadn't thought of before. And one of Garth's points in this essay, and it's been told to me, so I understand what it's about, is that it's the aesthetic of the book is queer somehow, you know, in its extravagance of emotion, in its excessiveness, in its melodrama, that there is a sort of, there is something that we associate with gay art, whether that's, you know, Douglas Sirk movies or whether it's visual art by Hernán Bass, that there is a sort of an extravagance of feeling. So I think it's I think it's a fascinating way of reading the book. And I think that I have been humbled that many of the people who have reached out to me have been gay men and have been so generous in letting me, as it were, write a book that they have taken to their hearts as something that reflects something of their experience. And to me, you know, although only one of the characters in the book names himself as gay, I do think that above all, it's a book about male intimacy and about male affection and about male love. And I wonder if, because we don't have a language to discuss those themes other than to name it gay, that's why it's being called a gay novel. But I'm tickled by it. I mean, it's certainly something that I love to hear.
I was really interested by the question of Jude's sexuality. We won't give details away, but it's clear that he's been abused. And when he finds himself in a relationship, in a couple of different relationships, they happen to be with men. But we never absolutely learn whether he's attracted to men or attracted to women or attracted to no one. And it seems to me that that's an interesting, it's another thing that the abuse has stolen from him.
Yes, I did think that Jude was someone for whom sex was, as an adult, an abstraction, something that didn't mean anything to his life anymore. And this is not, of course, to say that, you know, people who have suffered abuse react in one way or another to sex. But for this particular character, he had it taken from him. This idea of being a sexual person and of being a sexualized person was stolen from him.
I had to ask myself, reading, you know, you leave it a bit of a mystery in the beginning as to what's happened to Jude, and we learn that it's worse than what we might have imagined. Why is he not a monster?
I think that's a wonderful question. You know, I'm always interested in reading about what happens to people who end up high functioning after such trauma and people who don't. And the dividing line is simply luck, I think. You know, the person who is destroyed by the trauma that they've suffered, and the person who somehow manages to make an accommodation with it, as Jude does, although not ever fully overcome it, I don't know what that difference is. But I do think that this kind of trauma steals something huge from everyone. And for some people, it's apparent right away. They're not able to fit in to society, or they're not able to simply run their own lives. And for some people, you really have to dig, and the destruction is of a subtler, less apparent kind. But I am always, you know, having known people, as all of us do, who have suffered great trauma as young people, I'm always fascinated by how they are able to answer that trauma. And indeed, you know, in an earlier iteration of this book, before I actually started writing, it was going to be divided into three sections. And the first section was going to be Jude and the life that he has in the life of this book. So someone who is high functioning, who is competent, who can hold down a job, who is lovable. And in the second part of the book, it was going to be Jude, but someone who really did live at the margins of society. And all the characters' names would appear, but in different forms. They would be his drug counselors or his social workers or so on and so forth. Someone who really hadn't been able to make a life for himself. And then the third part of the book, the coda, would have been about what happened to him. And so that structure would have been much more directly about this question that I find fascinating about how does a human come back from or live with or answer great trauma in his life.
That's a really fascinating alternate path. What made you choose the format that the book finally took?
I think that it's a more intimate format, this format, and the other one felt a little too gimmicky. And there's a lot of tricks in the book, but I tried to keep it from being gimmicky. And I thought that the structure, that first structure I mentioned, would have been so much about the structure, that the structure itself would have been the story, that it wouldn't have been as emotionally resonant as I wanted.
I know that you famously fought very hard to leave in the book the many, many very graphic scenes of Jude hurting himself. And as a reader, I think you really want it to end, right? You just feel trapped within it, which I suppose is the way that Jude feels. Maybe he wants it to end, but he has no mechanism for stopping.
You know, Jude practices a certain kind of self-harm that we associate more with women, because women are taught to turn their anger inward and, mm-hmm. and men are encouraged to explode outwards in it. But like any sort of addiction that involves the destruction of the body, as almost all addictions do, whether it's anorexia or whether it's drug addiction, there is a sense that in the moment that you're hurting yourself, you are actually controlling your body and you're controlling your life, even if it means the destruction of your life. In in this book, it was important for me to have the amount of violence in it and brutality in it, self-imposed brutality in it, for a couple of reasons. I mean, the first three reasons. The first is that as a literary technique, it is like a little strand of music, a little bit of melody that repeats itself again and again and again, and really is a sort of leitmotif, something that runs throughout the entire arc of this book. The second is it felt true to who the character was, that as unbearable as it is as a reader sometimes, it is true to who the character is, and it's true to how he copes. And this is a character who is quite literal and relies upon the same mechanisms he's been given again and again and again, even though he knows he shouldn't and should stop. And the third thing is that once we start, I think, turning away from violence in art, we start turning away from violence in the news, we start turning away from violence in the lives of our own friends and people closest to us. Sometimes it is, life is very brutal for many people. And the reality of brutality is that it's uncomfortable and it's ugly and it's hard to bear and we'd rather not see it. But we owe a responsibility, whether it's to the people in our lives or to the people in the news or to the people on the page, to witness it. And I felt it was important to ask the reader to do some work here. And the reader's asked to do a lot of work in a lot of different ways in this book. But that was one of the things I really wanted the reader to do. I wanted the reader to feel and to be company for Jude in the darkest periods of his life.
The first trauma that he experiences is his abandonment in infancy. And, it seems to pale in comparison to other things. And yet that is like the original sin against him.
Yes. I mean, the book is very, and I've spoken about this in interviews, and the book is very fairy tale like in many ways. And it borrows many of the conventions and tropes from fairy tales, including, a child being abandoned and being asked to endure terrible suffering and the lack of parents, the lack of time, the lack of resolution, and the sort of hollowness of happiness is something that I really wanted to juxtapose against the scenes and the speech patterns and the ways of thinking of a contemporary naturalistic novel. And so you have right away, from the fact that Jude is a foundling, I hope that the reader is signaled that there is going to be, that this book is going to inhabit some sort of nether region that isn't quite a contemporary naturalistic novel and isn't quite not a contemporary naturalistic novel.
In a fairy tale, though, we are conditioned to expect that the foundling, no matter what he or she goes through, will sort of find joy. I found myself asking, would Jude have been better off if he hadn't survived?
Well, I do think that that's one of the questions I wanted to pose to the reader. Are there lives that are so difficult that perhaps they should end, and certainly that they should be allowed to end? We're very used to, in this culture and in most cultures that that believe in psychotherapy, to think that life is the answer to life always. And I don't think that's true. And of course, there is no metric of suffering or metric of despair that would allow anyone to ever say, well, this is it. This is too much for you. I mean, it's something that the individual has to make a choice for. But it does ask, I think, is life always the answer to life? Is life always the end goal of living, as it were? And I'm not sure that it is.
We're speaking this hour with novelist Hanya Yanagihara, editor at T, the New York Times Style magazine, and author of the novel A Little Life. She and I will be talking about A Little Life tonight for an Arts and Letters Live event at the Dallas Museum of Art. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can email think@kera.org, call 1-800-933-5372, or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with novelist Hanya Yanagihara. Her new book is called A Little Life. She's in town for an Arts and Letters live event tonight at the Dallas Museum of Art. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You were talking about therapy earlier. You wrote a piece for the New York Times Magazine last year where you said you confessed you were afraid of therapy. And you wrote, the fear of loss of control is greater than the hope for comfort. That sounds like something that, if nothing else, that you and Jude might have in common.
Yes, probably. I mean, you know, one of the things that I think this book also asks, and I'm not sure of the answer either, is whether, I mean, Jude is a person who's obsessed with dignity, having been given so little over the course of his life. He's determined to find it and to keep it as an adult. And the question is whether that search becomes oppressive and even harmful after a certain point. And, you know, this is a conversation that I have quite a bit with my best friend who's very pro-therapy and who is the reader on this book. And I don't know what the answer is, you know, but I do think that in Jude's case, so much has been taken from him that it sometimes feels that you have to protect whatever you have left, even if what you have left is corrosive and secretive and ultimately destroys you. But in a life in which you have so little, it can sometimes feel that you must cling to the few things that you do have.
I wrestled with that reading the book because in some ways this feels like a Victorian novel where, you know, if only the main character would tell the truth about something or would, you know, admit that she was in love with so and so, but propriety says that can't happen.
Right.
I just wanted him to tell someone.
Right. Right. You know, I think that there's an impossibility to speaking. And again and again, Jude is urged to speak and he wants to speak. And this idea that you have to be taught how to actually speak about yourself, this idea that you have to talk, to say, to begin a sentence with I or I feel, and then to add the adjective after, is actually a learned skill. And that's not true for everybody. I mean, not everyone learns that skill. Not every culture encourages the learning of that skill. And not every childhood teaches that, you know, encourages the real acting on that particular skill. And so I wanted to have someone who is maddening, you know, and of course, as a reader, you just want to reach into the book and shake him and say, if you just said something, things would automatically get better. I don't know if that's true. You know, we're a culture where we are encouraged to talk and we are encouraged to, if not confess, then at least share. I don't know whether it does anything for us. I think it might, but I certainly don't think it solves everything. And it solves the fundamental problem of who we are, which is, I think, perhaps unsolvable in a lot of cases.
There's a really poignant scene in the book for me, and it's a relatively minor one. Jude is thinking back to college and those late night sessions where you hang out with 8 or 10 of your friends and everybody, you know, you're kind of bearing your soul maybe after a couple of drinks, and he's observing and watching, knowing he cannot take part. He can listen, but he can't. He feels bad that he can't contribute, but he can't contribute.
Right. Right. And I do think for many people, what seems so easy for many of us is actually a tremendously difficult skill, and it's a particularly difficult skill. That idea of feeling entitled enough to share your own story and confident enough that you won't be rejected because of it.
It's a very American idea.
It's a very American idea. And it means that at some point in your life, in your childhood, someone has said to you, I want to hear what you have to say. Please tell me. And you've told them and they've been interested. And that is such that's an exchange that we all take for granted. And that many of us who have grown up with, you know, good enough parents or with good enough peers have learned. But not everyone does learn it. And it's a very difficult thing to learn in adulthood, I think.
This can't have been an easy book to write, period. You had a super demanding day job while you were working on it. Can you talk a little bit about how you were able to create this work and then go for 40, 50 hours a week to the New York Times, T Magazine? Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, you know, at the time, I actually wasn't at T. I started T in June. So before that, I was at Condé Nast Traveler, mm-hmm. and I was only working 4 days a week then. And anyone who works 4 days a week knows that fifth day is really like having 2 days. It's a great gift. And I really am an advocate for it. But I was just terrifically disciplined about this book. And I wasn't about my first book, and discipline is not something that comes naturally to me. And part of the reason I was able to be so disciplined about this book was because I really love spending time in the world of it, and I really knew where I was going with it. And that's not always the case, as any writer knows. So I would go to work, and I would work from about 10 to 7, and then I would, you know, go do whatever. And then I would come back, and I would write from 9 to 12. At night, Monday through Thursday, and then Friday, Saturday, Sunday, I would write 6 hours a day. And it was, there were times, of course, when I'd be at work and I would wish I were back in the life of the novel, but most of the time I was happy to get to work because it offered a reprieve. You know, when this book was very dark, and when I was working through a particularly thorny section, it was joyful to be in a place where you just, you know, were with your coworkers gossiping and having a good time. I mean, and actually doing work that was achievable and emotionless. And then I was equally pleased at the end of the day to dive back into the life of this book. You know, over the life of writing this book, I certainly did stop talking to most people. You know, I stopped going out, and my world became very small. And it had to, by necessity. There's a point in the book where JB, who's the painter, says that there's a moment in the creation of any work, or at least you hope for it, when the life of that creation becomes more real than life itself. And that was certainly the case for me. But I love spending time in this world so much. As torturous as it could occasionally be, it was also a thrill to be in it.
Interestingly, JB is the only character with whom Jude ever really has any conflict, and it's over something that most people would be sort of excited by and delighted by. He has used an image of Jude in a painting that gets a series of paintings that get a great deal of attention.
Yes, and you know, this is an argument I had. Well, there's a couple of things. I really love JB as a character. I relate to him the most, and he's the one who changes the most over the course of the book. Willem and Jude and Malcolm are fairly fixed in how they think and how they believe and how they see the world. And goodness comes naturally to them in a lot of ways, but it doesn't to JB. He's someone who really has to think hard about what it means to be a good person and what it means to be a good friend and what it means to make the right decisions about how to live his life. And I'm always sympathetic to a character like that, and I loved creating him. The point you mentioned was also resonant for me, because as an artist of any kind, where is the line between what you borrow from your friends' lives and what you don't? You know, I was talking again to my best friend about this, and he said, well, whenever I know a writer, I always assume they're going to steal from my life. Hmm. And I understand what he means. I didn't steal from anyone's life, not consciously for this book. But I understand the fear people have about novelists. A bad novelist will steal outright and steal huge swaths. But a good novelist will, too. You know, sometimes things are just irresistible. And it's always the tiny things about people's lives that are the most compelling, little details. And though I didn't take consciously from my friends' lives, when I go back and look at the book now, or I did several months ago, I can see little details that have crept their way in that I wasn't even aware of doing as I was writing. I think that is a question that I'm always thinking about. You know, what's the line between what I can do as an artist and what I must not do as a decent person and friend?
Separate and apart from the requisite skill that I don't possess, I couldn't write a novel and I couldn't write a memoir because I couldn't open myself up to people thinking, oh, I've read Hanya's novel. I know something about her.
Right.
How did you get over that? Or did you have to?
You just kind of can't think about it. I don't know how people write memoirs, because that really is, I mean, it's still a facade, and it's still something there's something artificial about it, but you really are divulging the facts of your life, which is, I don't know how people do it. It's, I admire people who can, or who can write personal essays. A novel, you have plausible deniability on almost everything. And there are people who are always going to think that it reveals something about you one way or another, and it feels tremendously exposing the first time it goes out into the world, because you do sort of wonder, not are people going to think that the things in this book happened to me, but what is this book going to reveal about me that I don't even know and someone is going to pick up on or interpret? And often that's what's scariest. It's not the facts of the book. It's what the book says about you that you're not even, that you don't even know about yourself.
One of the most frustrating things about the book for me, and frustrating in a good way, in a kind of creative way, was that ultimately Jude was almost selfish in keeping his suffering to himself, because a lot of people wanted nothing more than to make things better for him. And he could never quite accept that love in a way that felt fulfilling to them. And I don't think he meant to hurt those around him, but his pain really radiated because he wouldn't share it.
I'm glad that was frustrating, because, you know, Jude is a frustrating character and he's a maddening character. And I wanted him to be someone who was lovable, but didn't quite know how to accept love. And I think we all have people in our lives like that who ask for, not outright, but they ask for our sympathy and they invite our empathy. And they sometimes even invite our pity. And they don't quite know how to, having asked for that, how to take it in and how to sort of bat it back to you. It's not a volley that you can have with these people. It's almost like you're just dropping love and affection into this black hole, and the black hole never gets filled. And so as a reader, you know, you want to just reach into the book, and as I often did as a writer, and just really shake Jude around a little bit. You understand in a way why he also inspires hatred and why he inspires a sort of violence. And you want him to realize, which I think he does, how lucky he is to have picked the right people. And that is a gift I gave him, this ability to pick the right people, to pick the right people to be with and to love him. But again, like being able to talk about yourself, being accepting of love and affection is something that we have to be taught. And if we're not taught it in childhood, it's, again, extremely difficult to learn as an adult.
I want to talk about Jude's appearance. Over and over throughout the book, he is convinced that he is just hideous to behold. And we know that his body is scarred, but, you know, with clothes on, many people around him seem to find him quite attractive. You avoid ever actually giving us a physical description of his face.
I have a sense. I actually not even have a sense. I know exactly what Jude looks like, but I didn't want to try to cue the reader in one way or another. You know, his friends think he's beautiful, but we think that the people we love are beautiful, at least in some way. Whether he's objectively attractive, whatever that means, I leave that for the reader to decide. And it's in a way incidental. What he actually looks like is in a way incidental to who he is and to how people love him or don't, and to how he sees himself or he doesn't. Just as there is no sort of objective attractiveness, there is no objective grotesqueness. And I didn't want to try to convince the reader that he looked one way or he was one way, because I think that the reader responds to him as someone who is broken and not someone who is attractive or not.
There are several moments throughout the book where, even though I sort of had the sense that we wouldn't get there, it looked like a happily ever after was on the horizon. And I wonder, for you, writing those moments, what they felt like to you. Was there part of you that wished that you could, you know, fix everything for this character?
Yes, definitely. But it would have felt untrue to the book itself and to the narrative itself and to Jude's life itself. And I think that, you know, the problem with happy endings is that they're wonderful to read and they're very satisfying and I love them myself. But it is a lie many times. It is untrue. And it suggests that if a life doesn't end happily, it hasn't been somehow a true life, or that someone hasn't, that the person hasn't done enough to try to solve the problems of his own existence, which I don't think is compassionate. I mean, Jude's life ends exactly the way and the only way it could have ended, and in a way that felt true to who the character is and to how he thinks and to what he endured.
So we follow Jude and his friends over the course of 30 or 35 years. But it's really interesting because they seem to age and time kind of moves past them, but they're fixed at a moment. They always have cell phones and computers. Can you talk a little bit about your treatment of their position within time?
Yes. I mean, time is one of the things I really try to mess around with in this book. And as you said, there is a sense that I remember telling my editor that I wanted it to feel out of time, not so much timeless, but out of time. And so there were certain things I really – sometimes time moves very slowly. Sometimes it moves faster. Sometimes it moves not at all. And I originally wanted to make every section feel like it had been – like it was present day so that everything would feel like now. Mm-hmm. But I couldn't quite do it without, again, it seeming gimmicky. So instead, I just really played with the elasticity of time, and time is measured, you know, kind of purely by my own standards and not by anyone else's. For example, as you mentioned, the cell phones, they should be texting a lot more as the book goes on. But texting is a very unsatisfying literary device, and so I kept them on the phone. There are a few cues as to what time it is, what era they're in, but not that many. And I hope that, you know, as a reader, you either succumb to this or you don't. And if you don't, it's really going to bother you and it's really going to bug you. But if you do, it should feel, time itself should feel like something almost, I don't know, like almost sort of liquid, something that, you know, flows and sometimes it stops in a vessel and sometimes it leaves, but it's uncapturable. And I wanted that in a way to echo the sort of eternalness of this friendship, the sense that it wasn't measured so much in years. And, in fact, the characters themselves don't refer that much to time passing as they do to memory and as they do to moments. And so it's a collection of moments that make up a life rather than a collection of years.
We're speaking this hour with novelist Hanya Yanagihara. Her book is called A Little Life. She's in town for an Arts and Letters Live event tonight at the Dallas Museum of Art. She and I will sit down once again for another conversation. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Hanya Yanagihara. Her novel, A Little Life, is a prize-winning novel, was on many of the best books of 2015 lists. She'll talk about it tonight at Arts and Letters Live at the Dallas Museum of Art. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can email think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372. I have to tell you, I really loved Andy, the physician friend of Jude's and of everyone's, but he is very much like a brotherly figure. He's the one who will really try to stand up to Jude, but can never quite abandon him.
Right, right. I had a great time writing Andy, and, you know, my father's a doctor, and so he was very helpful in what Andy would know and wouldn't know. And it's, again, like so many of the relationships in this book, an idealized friendship. A friend recently accused me of writing friends that I would rather have rather than the ones I do. And while that's certainly not true, I wanted to have a constant in Jude's life, someone who had known him from a very young age and someone who was, until quite late in Jude's life, the only person who sees him physically naked and really understands why the body in this case is so distinct from the mind and would really be able to relate to him on that level. And also, as you said, try to get him to do things that he doesn't want to do. And it's very frustrating when you're a doctor and you have a patient who's as recalcitrant as Jude is. It's funny because my reader thought that Andy was kind of a jerk and was someone who really used his authority as a doctor to try to boss Jude around. And I thought he was a very sympathetic character and someone who was put in an impossible position. And in a position in much starker terms, but that all of Jude's friends tried to grapple with, which is how much can you do for someone who doesn't want to accept help or who is incapable of accepting help? And at what point do you stop? And what is your obligation to that friend? And I do think that all of us have someone in our lives who simultaneously asks to be saved. And then with everything they say and every action they take suggests that they don't really want to be saved after all. And the question then for us who love these people is, what are we obligated to do morally and ethically? How much should we be fighting for them? And is there ever a point in which we can give them permission to stop, even if giving people permission to stop means encouraging them to end their lives? So Andy really has difficult questions to answer, and it's compounded by the fact that he has a legal responsibility as Jude's doctor to take care of him.
Jude and his friends end up being very successful professionally. And, you know, some people who have taken issue with the fable-like aspects of this story have said, you know, why is everyone the poor little rich boy?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a ridiculous argument. I mean, well, the first thing is that this is why I think this book is a very New York novel. There are definitely, now my friends aren't like this, but there are definitely groups of friends in New York where everyone is successful in their given field. And New York, I think, unlike any other city, is really a place that fetishizes success. That successful people, however you define that term, whether you mean riches or renown or what have you, seek out other people because it's a way of validating that you yourself have made it, whatever making it means, and that you yourself have finally arrived in a certain sort of sphere that you've always wanted to be in. And that sort of ambition, that sort of seeking, that sort of collecting of success is one of the things that drives New York. And so you certainly do have these groups of friends, and they are in part attracted to one another because of everyone's success, that there's a sort of preening that goes on that, you know, well, this is my friend who does this, and this is my friend who does that, and this is my friend who won this, and this is my friend who won that. And the other thing is, you know, money is not... I certainly understand why people think this is a sort of one percenter book, and if they do, there's nothing I can say. But... And money is an important part of Jude's life. You know, the fact that he has money is not incidental. It pays for better medical care for him. It pays for help when he needs it. It pays for comfort, and it makes his life easier. What it doesn't do, obviously, is it's not ever able to repair the certain things that he needs repaired. It's not ever able to undo damage. It's not ever able to help him to the extent that he needs. And so, you know, it's of course more romantic to write about someone who is wouldn't have the money for many of these comforts, but money is something that can help him to a certain extent, but can't help him all the way.
It occurred to me that if he had had money problems, it would have been a novel about something very different because his life would have been consumed by the need to find more money.
Yes, you're absolutely right. I mean, then he would have been consumed. This would have been a book about healthcare and a very real book. And books have been written about that, about the struggle to find the money to make his life, to enable the physical facts of his life. And that isn't what this book is about.
Were you a kid who read a lot of fairy tales and fantasies?
Definitely. You know, I had parents who were who bought books all the time and who always encouraged me to read. And some of the narratives that I remember the most were the strangest. I mean, I remember there's this book, and now I can't find it, so I don't know if I just made this up, but I thought it was called Awake and Dreaming. And it was about this man who keeps having these terrible dreams, and he visits this witch doctor, and she gives him a potion, and he starts having these beautiful dreams. And they're such beautiful dreams that he can't stand waking life. And he says to the witch doctor, I can't go on living like this. And she gives him another potion, and he kills himself, essentially. So, and you realize when you go back as an adult and read these fairy tales, which we accept so willingly as children, that many of them, of course, as we know, are very brutal, but often they're very strange too, and they offer a great deal more ambiguity than we give them credit for offering, about what a meaningful life is, what a happy ending is, what valor is, what struggling is. And they are the first lessons we learn about how to see the world and what the world's consequences are. So they were definitely things I read. And the other interesting thing is the number of sort of thematic similarities and similarities of message that cut across fairy tales from the West, of course, but also from the East. Many of them have very similar lessons to impart.
It's really interesting because I think a lot of Americans get only fairy tales that come from the West, right? We have that tradition of we're handed all the things from Europe and Mother Goose, and then that's
right. Right. And there are, and that's what's really surprising, that you find similar lessons about, you know, about hard work, about obeying things, but also about how ephemeral happiness can be in both places like Grimm's and also places like Japanese folktales.
Fairy tales are so much about warnings, too.
Yes, they are. They're
what not to do.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And there's always a nice consequence that's going to happen. You know, if you do something wrong, you're never going to be able to get away with it. And, you know, life is very much like that for a lot of people, too.
Going back to what you said about, you know, New York fetishizing success, you had published a novel previously that was well reviewed and has, you know, done well. You worked for Condé Nast Traveler. Now you work for Tea. But I wonder if this novel has changed the kinds of people who want to take you to lunch and be your friend.
Not really. I mean, the nice thing about this book has been that it's allowed me to meet people who, and I'm always interested in meeting people who create or facilitate culture. And so it has allowed me to meet book editors I never would have been able to meet before, gallery owners I never would have been able to have access to before. And people, the lovely thing about writing or creating any sort of work of art that people respond to is the generosity with which people try to repay you, even though there is no real need for repayment. And often that means talking to you. It means offering whatever they can as a gesture. And it's the gesture itself that is the most meaningful. The fact that people have taken time to write me letters is terrifically moving for me. And simply the fact of people reading it has been astonishing. I think that most novelists know that your book will simply be greeted with a shrug if it's greeted at all. And that was certainly the case with my first book. So to have people who have read the book and engaged with it actively, whether they've liked it or not, has been a surprise and has also been an honor. But no, it's not like fabulous people are calling me and asking me out to lunch.
So why avoid reading reviews? Because like or hate what they have to say, reviewers typically have carefully read your work.
I don't think there's a point. You know, I think there's two reactions to reviews. You either only believe in the good ones,
right.
in which case you become sort of, you know, an ass. Or you believe both and it torments you. Mm-hmm. I'm never going to change the way I write because of a review. I'm never going to be able to change anything about this book, for better or for worse, because of a review. I respect reviewers, and there are people, I think, who I read quite a bit. But I just don't think the book is the book, and it exists, and there's nothing you could do about it. And I think reading reviews makes you more self-absorbed.
Have you been a confident writer from the start?
Yes.
And where do you think that came from? Which is to take nothing away from your ability.
No. You know, I really do think it was because, and as I get older, I realize how unusual this is, but I always had parents who taught me that I deserved a place at the table. Mm-hmm. And that the mistakes I would make and that that the things that I would do were simply part of growing up. And I think when you have parents who do teach you that what you have to say creatively is worth saying, then that's something that remains with you forever.
You lived for a while in Tyler, Texas.
Yes.
Which is, you know, not necessarily spoken about everywhere, but what are your memories of being there?
It was terrible. You know, I mean, we moved there because the university was not hiring doctors of color. And I think they lost some sort of state or federal lawsuit. And then my father and many other doctors were hired around that time. And so we had been living in Hawaii, which...
Boy, that's a rough switch.
It's a big transition, yes, which is where my parents had grown up as well. And it was very comfortable for all of us. And it was something that I was unprepared for. I mean, the great thing about being an Asian American in Hawaii is that, and it's why I find it so relaxing to go back now, you know that if someone is being mean to you, it's just because they don't like you. It's not because of what race you are. Hmm. And when I moved to Texas, it was the first time that I really understood what it meant to be hated for what I look like. And that makes you squirrely for the rest of your life, and it makes you defiant for the rest of your life in a lot of ways. And it makes you vengeful. And so I think, again, I was lucky because I had a father who really encouraged that anger and who didn't try to talk me out of it. I mean, it was his fault for moving us there. And it was it's a place that Texas, not Tyler necessarily, that I've grown to be fascinated by. But it was a very hard period of time for many reasons. You know, my mother wasn't allowed to join the PTA. There were certain, you know, pools that we wanted to go that we weren't allowed to join.
To make it clear to people who may not realize, you're a young woman. You're not like in your 70s.
This was in 84 through 89, I guess.
Wow.
And it was a much smaller town than it is now. And I'm sure people would think I was misremembering, but I knew at that point what it was like to feel physically vulnerable because of what I look like. And that is something that that I will always associate with that town.
Does New York offer safety from that kind of bias?
To some extent. You know, I mean, I think that everyone in New York is so busy trying to become who they want to become, that in a way there is bigotry and there is prejudice and there is racism, but mostly people are just too self-absorbed to really try to single you out because of difference, at least in my experience. And I happen to work in an industry that is, while very white, fairly prides itself on trying to work with differences of many different kinds, sometimes successfully and sometimes not.
All right. Hanya Yanagihara's new book is called A Little Life. She's editor at T, the New York Times Style Magazine. She and I will be back together this evening for Arts and Letters Live at the Dallas Museum of Art. I'm told there are still a few tickets left, so people can contact the DMA to find out about that. Hanya, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Chris, thank you so much.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Jeff Whittington is our executive producer. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.